Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy, interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood. Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California Volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit caneighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello. Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy, interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood. Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California Volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit caneighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello. Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy, interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood. Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California Volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit caneighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now. Driving, at your desk, maybe at the gym, but you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach and see a rocket launch or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Cricket Unfiltered podcast. I'm your co-host, Andrew Mensel. Joining me, as ever, is Paul Dennett. Paul, how are you?
Good, man. It's great to be here, as always.
Great to have you. And this is the third edition of the Winter Series. We've kicked it off with two fast bowlers, but now we're taking a bit of a different tack. And we have one of the most esteemed cricket journalists in the world joining us. And when I think of South African cricket, I think a few things, but one of the things right at the top is Neil Manthorpe. Neil, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. I mean, my premise for this winter special is I think that Australia and South Africa cricket contests are some of the most exciting series in the last, well, since South Africa's readmission, but they've also been some of the most hostile. There is a very, big rivalry between the two nations. And, you know, to bring you on and sort of do a little deep dive into it, I thought it'd be very interesting because, you know, it is such an important cricket rivalry.
It is, and it has been hostile. I mean, it's important to remember as well that there have been some contests which haven't been hostile, and there are some great friendships that have been formed. But I think it is fair to say that it is a characteristic of South Africa-Australia series that there's been hostility. And I get the sense you're just about to ask me where it comes from. Post-isolation was very different to the pre-isolation series. I don't think the same hostility was there pre-isolation. I think there was a lot more respect in the 50s and 60s, mutual respect. And South Africa weren't the force, of course, back then. Australia were very, very much the more dominant team. And so therefore, that prevented there being that competitive hostility. But post-isolation, Australia were very much the source of envy for the South African players. They had the history and the tradition and the bloody baggy green, mm-hmm. and South Africa had none of that, you see. They were very, very much a source of envy. And then South Africa got routinely thrashed for a couple of decades, or at least a decade and a half, which bred resentment, and they got a little bit upstarty, I think, and the Aussies were very keen to put South Africa in their place. So it was just a perfect alignment of the planets, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, you've been lucky enough to sort of cover South Africa since readmission, and you've seen, you know, a lot of the cricket up close, some good and bad memories. Let's start with your favourite memory of covering South Africa v Australia since readmission.
There have been lots, but nothing tops the Boxing Day Test match in 2008. I love the MCG. I'm an absolute G tragic, but. You know, that to coming off the back of the opening win in Perth, chasing 414, and it was the history. I mean, there's so few mountains to climb in international cricket. You know, so few records that haven't been broken. But South Africa had been trying to win in Australia for a century, you know, 11 tours, never won in Australia. So to win in Perth, and then... you know, I think Australians have probably forgotten just how far behind South Africa were in that Boxing Day Test match. You know, they when I'll remind you, just in case you.
Oh, no, you don't have to, Neil. I remember the Steyn partnership. Don't worry.
South Africa was still 10 runs behind when they lost their seventh wicket. You know, so they were looking at the follow-on. So to win by lunchtime on day five was incredible, and that's definitely my favorite moment. There have been lots of other ones that have been very enjoyable for different reasons, and then of course you had Graham Smith coming out to bat with his broken hand in the third Test match, so that's my favorite series, but to win for the first time in Australia was amazing.
And what about the worst memory, the most painful, and you know, this is going to take some picking through to narrow it down to one.
you don't need to ask me that, do you? Because you know the answer. I'll confirm it. I'll give you a couple of near misses. There's the New Year's Test match in 2002 when Australia were absolutely dominant. I mean, there was you know, that South Africa were hopeless. So Australia batted first. They made the usual 550. And things were going reasonably well for South Africa. And Herschel Gibbs and Gary Kirsten were batting. And I was sharing an apartment with the great Crash Craddock. And we decided it was one of those... Key West apartments, and so I decided that I was going to invite everyone round for a curry that night. So Malcolm Conn and the usual protagonists. So I popped out to buy some ingredients, and I was only gone a couple of hours. I wanted to get ready. It was going to be a late finish, and I was going to be cooking. So I went out and I got the ingredients to make the curry that evening. And when I got back into the SCG, I thought all was well because Herschel Gibbs was still batting. But South Africa had been bowled out in a session and followed on in my absence. So that was, I just thought, you know, we shouldn't be here. This is just humiliating. But no, it was the World Cup semi-final in 99. That was when my skin felt like it belonged to somebody else. It was a completely out-of-body experience. That was, and it took many years to get over that.
I fortunately was on the other side of that. I was a spectator there in the ground at Edgbaston that day, and I was one of those mad people that ran on the field as Donald was run out at right at the end there. So, you know, that's probably... almost my life highlight, let alone cricket highlight. Well, thanks for sharing those. Do you think that the hostility between, you know, Australia and South Africa really started? Because I felt that Hansie Cronje really, not only was he super competitive, but he really wanted to beat the Aussies.
He did. He did. And that remained his greatest cricketing regret. Until the day he died, but I don't think that he had a special dislike. He was very competitive and hated losing. And as captain of the team that got routinely thrashed by Australia, that wouldn't have improved his mood much. So it may have looked like he had more of a dislike for Australian cricketers than he actually did.
What do you think the average South African, I know it's a hard thing to say, but what's their viewpoint of Australians in general? Is there a level of animosity, or do they feel like there's a friendship between them? And has the ball tampering made much of a change to that, do you think?
Societally or just in the cricketing sense?
I suppose both. In the cricketing sense, I suppose, first of all, yeah, what they think of Australian fans and Australian players.
Well, I was determined not to talk too much about David Warner, but I'm afraid he did change the landscape considerably. And I, you know, there was a great deal of respect between the teams. A number of players crossed the Australian line in terms of, as far as South African cricketers were concerned. But Warner did so more than anybody else. And I have to say that there was very, very great lack of sympathy or empathy towards him when the ball tampering incident happened. And that was really deeply unfortunate. In many senses, the couple of series that preceded that, actually, you know, there was in terms of behaviour from both teams, it was, as Gideon Hay said a couple of months ago, it was a race to the bottom. Australia won it, but it was pretty undignified.
I mean, that series win for South Africa, 2017, must be so significant. Winning at home against the Aussies for the first time since readmission must have been just very special for the playing group.
Well, huge. Absolutely. Yeah, massive. And that also was one of those mountains that had to be climbed. And it really, really hurt. South Africa had, as I said, almost a century of getting used to going to Australia and losing and not being able to win there. They'd become accustomed to that, but it really hurt. It's the only team that hadn't been beaten on South African soil, since isolation. So it was massive. It was huge. The tone was set, wasn't it, in the first test? You know, you had both teams getting reverse swing before the ball was 20 overs old. Mm. And there was a lot of confusion, would be a polite way of putting it, but anger and suspicion amongst the Australians that I was aware of. And I'm amazed that it hasn't really been much, hasn't been made of it in the years subsequent to the ball tampering thing. But the Australians felt that South Africans were up to something with the ball, and no doubt they were. It was a very rough outfield, a rough wicket. So, you know, both teams were throwing the ball in into the ground and getting one side to scuff up. But that was really, really nasty. That was a ill-tempered, almost unpleasant to watch test match, and the tone was set. And in retrospect, and I have said this on a number of occasions, it was a pity that the match referee and the umpires, you know, we didn't have senior umpires for that series and very experienced umpires. I just think in retrospect, somebody could have, you know, got the captains together, knocked their heads together and said, listen, boys, you need to cool off.
Yeah, it just all fed into each other, didn't it, that series? You had the de Kock incident and the stairwell and then the Rabada getting let off. It built up and it exploded, which has happened before with Australia and South Africa. Do you feel from your point of view, Neil, that I often feel that the difference between South Africa and some other teams is South Africa won't take a backward step. If Australia comes at them, they're willing to go toe-to-toe, whereas I feel that some other nations won't.
Yeah, that's true. There've been some pretty tough characters in the South African teams over the years. What was interesting, actually, to me was that the first team to win Graham Smith's team in 2008 adopted a very, very, not meek and mild, but they went out of their way to play the good guy. And they spoke to, they granted every media interview. Previous teams had been reticent and intimidated by the media and the way the Australian player, their perception of the way the Australian players used the media, and they felt that it was biased, and they adopted this sort of they circled the wagons, you know, had adopted the Kroll mentality, and it was Graham Smith and Mickey Arthur in 2008 said, you know what? What are we scared of? What the hell are we? Why are we retreating? We just need to open up, be ourselves, be honest, and then laugh it off if somebody stitches us up in the newspaper, and that's what they were. And they Smith in particular, the young captain, was determined to show the Australians that you didn't have to behave like a dickhead to win.
Just switching tack, what's the future of the short-term future of South African cricket looking like? We've been hearing from afar of turmoil with the board and journalists having their accreditation revoked and a general lack of confidence. Has that settled down? Have you got some optimism for the next few years?
It's as bad as ever, I'm afraid. So there was a huge wave of optimism a couple of months ago when Graham Smith was appointed as director of cricket. And his influence is astonishing in world cricket. You know, the Cricket South Africa is heading towards bankruptcy at pace, losing money left, right and center. The only reason they're not bankrupt is because the rand is depreciating so quickly and their dollar-based income is worth more and more. That's kept them afloat. But Graham Smith, as director of cricket, one of the first things he did was fly to Calcutta, meet up with his old mate Sourav Ganguly, and persuade him to agree to a unscheduled 3 T20 international tour, which is worth $10 million, and at current exchange rate of 18 to 1, it's 180 million rand. Graham Smith could just do that. Then spoke to the ECB, persuaded them to play 3 T20 internationals as part of their short tour towards the end of the year. So, you know, in the space of a month, he generated pre-COVID, of course, it potentially generated, you know, 200 million rand. And then the CSA president, Chris Nanzani, went to appear before the sports minister in a parliamentary portfolio committee meeting last week. And the minister said, why did you appoint a white man as director of cricket? So we're never, ever, ever more than, you know, a few centimetres away from race, racial tension. And it just pervades, it's pervasive, and it affects everything. So, you know, the chief executive was suspended, Thabang Moreau, for allegations of malpractice and misappropriation of funds and credit card abuse, all sorts of things. He's been suspended for 6 months on full pay, and it's not being resolved because it's perceived to be a racial issue. So South Africa is facing a constant battle. On the field and particularly off it.
Yeah, it must be very hard for the proud South African fans to see a lot of players go and either go coal pack deals and play in England, or like Peterson and Labuschagne emigrate and then go on and have successful careers for other countries.
It's interesting you mentioned those two. There's a big difference, isn't there? I mean, Labuschagne left when he was he 10?
That's
yeah, I mean, that good on him. Lots of South Africans have emigrated to Australia.
A lot of them are here in Sydney, Neil. I've met them all. I've met them all in cafes.
Most of them are in Perth, aren't they? They call them the boat people.
Perth as well, yeah.
Yeah, so that, you know, South Africa does have a lot of problems. And if you decide to leave, then keep your mouth shut. That was all. That was the, you know, that you don't. But those of us who remain here have to live with those problems, and you don't need people leaving with a gob full of abuse for the country that that they were born in, and that was, you know, mostly pretty good to them. So there's no resentment, but apart from in Peterson's case, you know. Guys like Kyle Abbott, for example, he's sad, you know. I mean, he's happy that he's got a great deal with Hampshire, and he's and there's a regular cricket, and selection is entirely on merit, and he's got security, and he's being very well paid. But you know, it wasn't an easy decision for him.
When he came out here in 2016 and destroyed Australia, I was sort of thinking, he's on the verge of being just about the best bowler in the world. Is it naive of me to say that maybe world cricket should have done something and India and Australia and England dipped into their pockets and said, we understand the financial situation. Here's enough money for the top players like him to stay in South Africa so that we don't lose them to the international game?
It's interesting, isn't it? There, I mean, there has been talk on and off about minimum salaries for Test match appearances around the world. I don't think it's practical. It is a lovely idea, and you know, I mean, Kyle Abbott. It is about money, you know, but he would have got a national contract, I suppose, but. You know, he like everybody else. I mean, unless you're Jacques Callis or Dale Steyn or AB de Villiers, you know. But if you're a fast bowler, you look at the demographics of the squad, and you say, well, there have to be five, six players of colour in the team. You've got Kagiso Rabada, Lungi Ngidi, Vernon Philander, and you know, but it's the same reason that Duane Olafeer, who also destroyed Pakistan in his last Test series, you know, he took 23 wickets in three Test matches. But you know, because there's a lack of black batsmen, and a lot of very very fine black fast bowlers, guys like Abbott and Olafeer will. That very carefully, very, very astutely, won't say it publicly, but you just look at the numbers and look at, you know, where the black talent is, and it's hard not to reach the conclusion that you know you're going to struggle to be a regular.
So, do you think the quota system is a loaded question? But is the quota system the right system?
Yeah, it does. It needs to be represented. The national team needs to be representative. It absolutely does. And you can't. You can sit back in a utopian world and say just select on merit. If you're good enough, you're good enough. But it doesn't work like that. You know, take away all of the moralizing, look at it from a financial perspective. If you've got a big sponsor, a big bank, a big brand in South Africa, they want to sell their product to 90% of the market. And they're not going to sponsor a team that is made up of 10% of the population or 15% of the population. I mean, it really comes down to that. You know, that's when we say the team needs to be representative, people assume that that's a philanthropic ideal for the demographic of the team, but it is. I mean, it should be. It should be representative, but it's also a very, very practical issue. And so is the quota system the right? It doesn't sit easily with almost anybody. But it's a necessity. It's a necessity because the team isn't being selected in a demographically representative way otherwise.
Just switching to something a bit local, the Sydney Sixers in the WBBL have a couple of outstanding female players in Danae Van Niekerk and Marizana Kapp. How is women's cricket going in South Africa? In Australia, it's the feel-good story of almost sport, and the Australian women's cricket team embraces one of the most popular national sides. How's women's cricket going in South Africa?
It's on a steep ascent. I mean, from virtually a standing start. You know, 3 or 4 years ago, it was very, very marginalized and very sparsely supported. It was a real battle for the ladies to keep the game alive. At domestic level, it was virtually non-existent, strictly amateur. And then 3 years ago, they got momentum. Financial services company stepped in and offered 6 professional contracts. And that didn't work. So how do you pick 6?
Yeah.
So they then made that 12 and it's now 15. And Cricket South Africa are taking women's cricket more seriously than they ever have done before. There has been talk about equal pay, just talk at this stage. But for the first time at the T20 World Cup, you just had cricket people. You know, before it was supporters of women's cricket, but the T20 World Cup and the run to the semi-finals, you had just cricket people around the country watching for the first time that I'm seriously aware of. So it's now, women's cricket's now a major player.
Oh, good to hear.
The success of the men's side over the last few years has been a constant ever since readmission, that whether South Africa, to my eyes anyway, South Africa has never been anything other than ranging from pretty good to excellent. With the turmoil off the field, is there a danger that will change? Do you fear for the men's team's performance in the coming years that they will slip from their high position at the moment?
I don't, you know. And the reason for that is that South Africa has always been a net exporter of cricketers. And that's been going on for 100 years. You know, it's not just Marnus Labuschagne or Labuschagne who's gone to Australia. It's, look at the England team over the last 50 years. There's always been a South African in it. And that's because of the school system. You know, there's 50-plus schools which have magnificent facilities, really brilliant facilities. You know, there's the weather, the history, the culture, and so, you know, there are only 6 franchise teams. And so if you've got 50 schools playing cricket to a very high level, and if each one of them, even if only half of them produce one potential first-class cricketer, there's still not enough space for them to earn a living. And that South African team that I mentioned, you look at Hashim Amla and Graham Smith and AB de Villiers and Dale Steyn and Sean Pollock, and you know they're all sort of once in a generation kind of cricketers, and suddenly there were 5 of them in the same team. So it's very hard to expect those kind of standards to be met. But I just think that provided that there's good coaching, and that is really important, I think South Africa will continue to produce very, very good cricketers, and a lot of them will go overseas, and a lot of them will leave, and some may take up golf instead of cricket. And there will be a lot less money in cricket, I think, around the world in post-COVID 19, post-coronavirus times. But I just think South Africa will remain competitive.
I heard Crash on the radio, or actually another podcast recently, telling the story of following the Cronje scandal. And he said that he was staying with you at the time, maybe. So it seems like you've got a good relationship with the Australian cricket media. You mentioned Malcolm Conn, who Paul and I both know very well. So I guess a couple of questions on that. So how's your relationship with the Australian cricket media? Because they're known to be pretty hostile, not so much to journalists, but the way they write. And just generally, since readmission, as a journalist, you have had a stack of stuff to write about. I mean, there hasn't been thin on stories in South African cricket.
some of the best people I know on earth are the Australian cricket media. Some brilliant, brilliant men. Mike Coward was not exactly on his way to the airport, but he booked his tickets. He was bringing his partner Peter to come and stay with us in Cape Town. Peter's never been to South Africa before, so he's like a godfather to me. Unfortunately, he had to cancel, obviously. But I really, really enjoy the Australian cricket media. I really do. And it was a source of extreme frustration and amusement in many ways, that for so long South African cricketers felt that the Australian media were biased and they were almost an ally to the Australian team. And I tried to explain. I said, no, it's not true. It's not true. They write rubbish about you because you're playing rubbish. But I said, you know, have you ever seen the Australian newspapers when an Australian cricketer goes wrong, goes off the rails? Or when they get thrashed, or when they have you seen them turn on their own? And of course, none of them have because Australia always won when they played against South Africa for so long. But I think it's tough. It's really the media in Australia is very competitive. I mean, it's the second most competitive that I've experienced. There's obviously the English media, where, you know, everyone's looking for a scoop and everyone wants exclusives left, right and centre. And that exists in Australia, although less so now. It's basically just kind of two groups, isn't it? But we don't have that in South Africa. We don't have it. We're very, very soft. And it's very few people prepared to say it like it is and to, you know, to put it down in black and white.
Yeah, don't worry, Crash will do that if he has to. There's no doubt about that. But he says exactly what you said, Neil, that they will hammer the Aussies just as much as they hammer overseas teams. So they say it's very fair.
Yeah, and I've seen it. Jeepers, the 2016 series, that was some bloodletting there. Goodness me, it was a weak Australian team, wasn't it? But, you know, I mean, I actually brought some newspapers back with me. I've got them here in my study because it was brutal. It was some of the most brutal sports writing I've ever experienced. honestly, you'd have thought that there'd been assassinations taking place. It was, after South Africa's win in Hobart, five players were dropped, weren't they?
That's right. If you'd been here after the sandpaper scandal, you would have seen that times 10 or 20. It was quite the explosion. Paul, have you got any questions for Neil before we get on to our last segment?
I was just going to ask, we've probably got a lot of listeners, Neil, who are Australians who've never travelled to South Africa who would love to, say, follow the Australian side over there. You probably get asked this a lot and it's probably not something you like to get asked, but is it a safe country for someone from Australia to visit? Do you need to be on an organised tour? Should people come?
I don't mind being asked that question at all, and I'm delighted to answer it. I'll tell you a little story. When Gary Kirsten got appointed as head coach of India, we chatted about it at some length. I've known Gary for a long time. I wrote his book after he retired. And he said to me, just casually, he said, yeah, well, Debs and I are thinking of that we'll be based in Dubai. And I kept my cool, but only just. I said, Gary, national coach of India. and you're going to live in Dubai. I said, why would you do that? He said, oh, you know, just sort of healthcare and that kind of thing. I said, Gary, there's 1.4 billion people live in that country. There's 500 million children. You're not thinking this through. And Australians need to remember that there's 60 million people in South Africa, and we have children, and the country has its problems. But, you know, ask yourself this. I mean, are there certain areas of downtown Sydney where you'd be concerned about going after 10 o'clock at night? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've never been past the Rocks in Sydney. And the 15 times I've been there, it's the SCD and the Rocks, me. But, you know, I mean, I know that, you know, there are certain parts of Manchester and Liverpool and places in the UK.
Plenty of cities in the States where if you take the wrong turn, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. So all I would say, you don't need to be on an organized tour to come to South Africa. You know, you don't. There are very, very, very poor, underprivileged areas where gangsterism is rife and drugs are rife and life is cheap. And unfortunately, it can be dangerous, particularly for the inexperienced and the uninitiated. But that's generally speaking not a side of South Africa that you will come anywhere near. If you come on a cricket tour or you go and visit the Kruger National Park and many of the other sites and tourist destinations in the country, it's a very, very beautiful country with beaches and winelands and mountains and you know, it's... If you stick to the path and follow the signs, then it can also be a very safe country. But it does have extreme poverty.
It's good to hear that. I think Menas and I are very keen at some stage to get over there for a cricket series or something else. So yeah, that's really encouraging, and hope our listeners. Visit the next time when we're all travelling around the world again.
Oh, I look forward to showing you around.
Well, Neil, we're ending every Winter Series podcast with making our guest the ruler of cricket. So we're going to give you things to decide on, and you can tell us briefly yes or no, basically. I'll start things off with the first question is, do you understand this three-team format of cricket that was invented in South Africa recently?
I think I do understand it. It hasn't been played, so I haven't seen it. But the really, really amusing thing is that every time somebody's tried to explain the rules, it sounded very, very complicated. and it's been hilarious because, you know, it's the organisers and the guys who conceived it, we had a virtual press conference, a Zoom press conference, and every time they were asked a technical question, they talked themselves straight into a hole from which they found it very, very hard to talk themselves out of it. And so I found that as well, because it's so unfamiliar and it's unprecedented. And because we are so familiar with the rules of conventional cricket, it becomes really tricky trying to explain it. So don't ask me to explain it, but I think I understand it. So there's three teams and they all bat for six overs twice.
Yeah, that's how I understood it. And there's a gold, silver and a bronze. And if there's a three-way tie, they all get gold medals. So what about something a little bit more conventional, four-day test matches? You got a problem with that?
I want to have a problem with it, but I don't. I really, really sympathize with traditionalists who say test matches are 5 days and that's it. And that's always the way it's been. Well, that's absolute rubbish. Of course, test matches have been 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, 6 days, and timeless. And it just makes so much sense as far as the scheduling goes. You know, there aren't enough days in the year. Everybody wants to tour. You know, so to have a three test series in 3 weeks just makes so much sense. Mm. Thursday to Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday off, Thursday to Sunday, you know, done and dusted, three tests in 3 weeks. And it would work. You know, there are a lot of test matches that don't go to the fifth day anyway, increasingly so. And for countries that I was going to say, for rich countries like England, India and Australia, but you're not rich anymore, are you? You also got a few financial problems in Australia.
That's a low blow.
but for the countries like South Africa, who have been struggling financially for years, it's very costly to have that fifth day that's not being used. And in fact, there, you know, we've had a number of 3 day test matches. And I know that I honestly, it's a subject that I've written extensively about and spoken about extensively and spoken to a lot of people. I'm aware of all of the arguments. And may I just say, what's wrong with the Ashes remaining 5 days? I don't have a problem with some test matches being 4 days and some being 5 days. I absolutely don't have a problem with that at all.
What about the amount of teams in a World Cup? There's been a lot of talk that, you know, when the ICC contracted the 50-over World Cup, that it was bad for the health of international cricket. Which side of the fence are you sitting on that one?
14 teams. I had long arguments with discussions bordering on arguments with Haroon Loggat when he was chief executive of the ICC. And he said, we're moving all of the associate nations towards the T20 World Cup. That's going to be their World Cup. And of course, that is exactly how it's transpired, except that it's not really, because all the minnows go and swim in a small pond for 2 weeks before the big boys arrive. So, you know, it's a compromise, but definitely for me, there have been some wonderful performances. And I also think that the quality of cricket being played by the Associate Nations is improving. Yep. I think they're getting better and better and better. And you know, it was a problem, wasn't it? When you had teams clearly out of their depth. But nowadays there is more and more of the possibility of a surprise. And, you know, teams like the UAE, Dougie Brown's doing an amazing job as coach of the UAE, and teams like Scotland and the Netherlands, and, you know, I mean, how can we have 12 test playing nations and only 10 of them get to play in the World Cup? That's just nonsense.
I agree.
Neil, if you had to pick the four best South African batsmen ever, my short list, and you can disagree with this, but if you agree with them, how would you rank them? Of Hallis, de Villiers, Barry Richards and Graham Pollock.
That was just brutal. That's a horrible, horrible question. completely unanswerable. I printed it off, and I've... the listeners won't be able to see if I hold it up to the screen. You'll be able to see I've written number 1, 2, 3, and 4 and crossed them out about 16 times. I mean, honestly, Graham Pollock, Barry Richards, Jacques Callis and AB de Villiers. I mean, that's just... can you rate them? can you, either of you? Honestly, well, can you go 1, 2, 3, 4 with those four?
If I had to do it, I'd have Callis at 4. I'd have... it's hard. I'd have de Villiers at 3. I'd have Richards at 2 with an asterisk that I think if he actually got to play more test cricket, because I think he got a bit bored in county cricket, and I'd have Graham Pollock at 1. But if you ask me tomorrow, I'll probably have a different order.
Yeah, that's just... That you're showing a historical bias there, because you've gone in reverse age order.
It's true.
Honestly, I mean, you know, different I mean, if I said to you, you need someone to score 100 before lunch, then you're not going to go with Jacques Kallis. But, you know, if you want someone to bat 100 overs, which of those four you said, I absolutely need someone to bat 100 overs for my life, which one would you go with?
Kallis, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, they are quite different, aren't they? I think you'd definitely want, well, would you go with Barry Richards or A.B. de Villiers to score you 100 off 100 balls?
Probably A.B. de Villiers, but that's kind of now flipping my bias around to bias for modern times. Had Barry Richards grown up at the same time as A.B. de Villiers, it might have been a different story.
Yeah. Good question, but impossible. I give up. I can't do it.
No, you've been very lucky, though. You did get to watch Kallis and de Villiers play a number of test matches and score plenty of hundreds. Neil, thank you so much for joining us on the winter series of the Cricket Unfiltered podcast. I was trying to think, what was your first tour to Australia? Was it 92, 93?
93, 94.
93, 94, wasn't it? Yeah.
And because I remember even back then when it's South Africa stole that test match at the SCG with Fani de Villiers steaming in. Then after the game, Fani was on the outfield with his car, his remote control car, and you were there. And I was being serious at the top. When I think of South African cricket, I think of, your great work around the team. And it's just an absolute pleasure to finally have you on the podcast. So thank you.
Ralph, thank you for having me. It's been great. I've got plenty of time on my hands at the moment.
Don't we all?
Well, thanks very much, Neil.
Thanks for having me.
So you can head to Manners on Cricket if you want to see all of Neil's work. This is the third edition of the Winter Series. We'll be back soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy. Interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood? Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit caneighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.